several years ago, at the end of a retreat that we were offering on Maui, we invited the local Sangha to come to the retreat venue to pack up all of the mats and the cushions and the kitchen equipment and everything we need to host a retreat at a rented facility. And so, you know, a number of people show up and it takes the whole day. We disassemble the retreat setting, take everything back to the house, pack it all in storage containers and put it in a storage room for the next retreat. And at the end of the day, I was looking around to see that we had taken care of everything, and I saw a box of kitchen supplies over there. And I went over to the kitchen supplies box and rummaged around, and I picked up a box and I said to my friend Duke, "How would you like a box of wheat-free, dairy-free, gluten-free, sugar-free, chocolate-less chocolate chip cookies?" And he said, "Oh, there are some things in life I can do without." And I think that this is a mantra we should get used to more often. There are some things in life I can do without. Because most of us have very busy, full, complex lives. And we're always short of time. Life is very complex. And we wonder sometimes, how did it get this way and what can I do about it? The Buddha had an answer. Let go. Let go. Let go. Let go. And yet it's very difficult to let go. You might have noticed during the sitting that we just had that while I didn't give you any assignment other than to remember to recognize the present moment, be aware, the mind gave itself assignment. It starts solving problems, it finishes conversations, it makes plans for later, it comments on everything you experience or don't experience, and it evaluates it against what you would like to have experienced or what you think should be happening. And so even though we're invited to just let go of doing anything, we can't. And why not? Not because we don't have the interest to simplify our life or to let go of some of the stuff, activities, mental chatter, emotional baggage that we carry around or that we are heir to. We'd like to, but it's not easy, is it? So I want to speak about simplifying our life. I want to speak about letting go. I want to speak about how to do without and how to do quite well, actually, without a lot of things that we're entangled in life. I'm going to use the word that the Buddha used, nekama, which is usually translated as renunciation. And let's face it, when I say we should be practicing renunciation, or I'm going to talk about renunciation, you might have an image in your mind of renunciation. That's a deprivation. That's a kind of a state of not having enough and being deprived and not being able to do what you want to do. But actually, the Buddha was a renunciate. The Buddha was a renunciate who learned how to simplify his life, how to let go of that which causes suffering. The suffering of impatience, the suffering of self-judgment, the suffering of depression, anxiety, fear, jealousy. And if we haven't all let go of that, we've got some renunciation to do. Right? So renunciation doesn't have to have a bad word. It doesn't have to mean kind of a difficult, strenuous deprivation. It can be as simple as learning to let go of what you no longer need. But we have this image of the Bodhisattva, who Prince Siddhartha, who eventually became the Buddha, living his first 29 years of his last life as a prince, or living in a very royal, luxurious lifestyle with an abundance of everything that it needed and it could indulge in, much like we live today. And then we have the Bodhisattva, due to his karmic aspiration and his the power of his commitment to awaken, kind of taking the opportunity to slip outside of his father's realm, the protection of his father's realm, and he saw what are called the four heavenly messengers, one of which was an elderly person, one of which was a sick person, the third of which was a corpse. And when he saw these three, he understood. We could say it's not like he saw them for the first time. He saw them in his heart, mind, and what it meant as a human being to grow old, inevitably get sick, and inevitably die. He saw that. He understood that. He recognized that. And he recognized the immense amount of suffering and struggle and fear and apprehension and unknown and insecurity and that all that provoked within him and all of us. So what does it mean that the Bodhisattva left his father's palace and saw what he hadn't seen before? Well, it means that he momentarily, if you will, through some adventitious conditions, was able to escape his conditioning, was able to kind of slip outside of the family cultural conditioning of this is the way it is, this is how you should understand it, and this is what it, life is great, right? And he saw things as they really are. And so a lot of Dharma practice is just that. It is an awareness practice just like that. We all live in our deeply conditioned family of origin, cultural, ethnic, gender, political, economic, social, environmental conditioning. We have never been without it. We've never been free of it. It is so habituated to us that we live it as if this is the way it is. How do we get outside of our conditioning? How do we see from outside of everything we've learned? That's a challenge, isn't it? You know, but what we do when we practice awareness is we pay attention and we see these layers of conditioning. We see how habituated we are to understand or misunderstand or to perceive things as we've been taught and not to see them as they really are. And so a lot of what we're doing with awareness practice is trying to get out of our parents' house to see things for ourselves that they cannot show us. And this is why the Buddha says, when you practice the Dharma, you will be going against the stream. It's not just the Dharma punks that go against the stream. We're all going against the stream. Because the stream of our conditioning is going to take us happily, just kind of along to the oblivion of falling asleep and just doing what's expected of us. And if you want to wake up to the truth of things, if you want to see what's really going on, you have to go against that flow of conditioning, against the stream of your conditioning. Doesn't mean you have to be a rebel, you don't have to be antagonistic, you just have to be willing to step outside of your comfort zone, or to stay, or maybe I should say step inside of your discomfort zone. I think that's more accurate, yes. Yeah, step inside of your discomfort zone. So when we hear this story of the Prince Siddhartha, and we hear that he kind of woke up to these three conditions of life, and then he felt moved to find a way out of that kind of suffering. And he left home, left his father's palace, protection, conditioning, and went on the spiritual search, the spiritual journey of awakening that was common then, even common now. And he was motivated to do that because he saw, as the fourth heavenly messenger, a renunciate, someone who had chosen to live their life without all the comforts that he had known, and actually was seemingly quite happy, even. Not like the one who was sick, elderly, dying. But so he undertook the practices of his day, the spiritual practices of his day, which were great, austere, ascetic, severe, physically and mentally torturous disciplines. And if you read about that, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. And at some point he said, this isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't freedom. As much as he had perfected everything that was known to be the spiritual awakening of his day, and he'd perfected that and been invited to be the senior teacher of that particular tradition, all of those traditions, he said, this isn't it. That isn't it. Much like we have been offered all kinds of options for spiritual practice. Is it for you yet? Or maybe not? Okay, so when he was at the point of recognizing, this doesn't work, this isn't it, this is not freedom from suffering, and he wondered what to do, then he had this vision of when he was a young boy, sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree, watching his father ritually plow a field as a kind of a aspiration or an auspicious event for a bountiful harvest. And while he was just sitting there, interested in what's going on, but in a very relaxed way, he spontaneously entered an exalted state of mind. We think it's jhana, or some kind of samadhi. Spontaneous, when he's a little boy. And he remembered that when he was in this severely emaciated, ascetic, renunciate state of mind. He remembered that and said, huh, maybe that's the way to practice. Maybe that's the way to this liberation or awakening. But this was from his own experience. Nobody told him, look for that. Nobody told him that might be the way. This is something he intuited for himself. We may have to do that too. We may have the spiritual practices of our day perfected, mastered, listened to every spiritual teacher there is, memorized it all, still not be free. Then what? So, after those years of ascetic practice, after those years of indulgent living in the father's palace with abundance of everything that could possibly enjoy, he characterized his awakening, the understanding of his awakening, as the happiness of peace through renunciation, the middle way between denial and indulgence. In our society, we don't have many role models for renunciation. Nobody is trying to sell you, let go, don't buy this, don't do this, don't engage in this, don't pick this up. When I was in Europe, I saw a sign at a train station, and it was blinking. Do not get on. Do not get on. Remember that. When the next option comes around, to do, to become, to have, to get, to want, do not buy in. Do not get on. Because if you don't hang on, you don't have to let go. Anyway, here we have this renunciate characterizing his realization as happiness of peace through renunciation. And we don't have good role models in our society. In our culture. Can you name any good kind of popular renunciate? It's hard, isn't it? It's like, no, we don't. Okay, so the Buddha, in his teaching, you know, his realization of the truth, he characterizes these four truths, which are, there's the truth of dukkha, which is, there's pain, there's suffering, there's insecurity, there's oppression in life. You got it? You believe that? Is that true for you? Pain? Anybody not have pain? Anybody not have insecurity? Anybody not have oppressive conditions in their life at times? At times. Okay, he must have been true. The second noble truth was, all that's caused by clinging, craving, holding on to something, which inevitably leads to this pain, to this insecurity, that whatever you're holding on to will disappear or die or get old or something. And if this pain is caused by holding on, then letting go has got to be the way to the end of pain, to the end of dukkha, to the end of insecurity, to the end of vulnerability, to the end of oppression. So when he talks about being a renunciate, or when we understand the Buddha as being a renunciate, he's actually practicing the second noble truth, letting go. Letting go of clinging, letting go of craving, letting go of holding on. And he says of letting go, or renunciation, he says, if by renouncing, letting go, a lesser happiness, one can attain to a happiness that is greater, then those who are wise will pursue that happiness which is greater. He's not saying you have to give up something that's painful, even. He's just saying, if you're happy, but if you give up that happiness, you can have a greater happiness. And greater happiness means not so much a fleeting experience of pleasure as it is a greater happiness is a sense of well-being that is possible to access or to feel, to acknowledge, even if it's an unpleasant situation. So rather than seeking pleasure, sensory pleasure of any sort, physical, mental, emotional, psychological, financial, economic, personal, sexual, anything, right? Rather than seeking pleasure there, if you can let go of that and have, as a kind of a default setting of your mind, a sense of well-being, would you do it? The Buddha said those who are wise would do that, would pursue that greater, more subtle, more enduring, more interior happiness rather than the fleeting happiness of pleasure. Okay, so hey, there was an experiment, now it's about 40 years ago, with young kids. And these tormenting psychologists had this experiment with these young kids, and they had them in a room, and they brought into the room some candy. And they gave all the kids, little kids, a candy bar or some popcorn or something. They gave them something that kids really like. And they said, okay, this is yours, you can have it. But I got to leave the room right now. And when I come back, if you still have your candy bar, I'll give you another one. But if you want, you can eat your candy bar now. So the psychologist went out of the room, turned around to watch the children through their mirror, and what did they see? Some of the kids, they just took that candy bar, boop, ate it. There. They knew they wanted that pleasure. And some of them said, no, I don't want this now, I want two later. They just put it aside and just waited for them to come back so they could have two. But the majority just kind of like looked at it, picked it up, smelled it, felt it, maybe even unwrapped it, licked it, just wanted to eat it, but didn't want to eat it. They wanted it, but they wanted two. So 40 years later, they have found out that those who are able to just take that candy bar and put it aside and wait for two have done well in life. They're still tracking them 30, 40 years later. What those kids, now adults, are doing with their life. So this ability to put aside a momentary, a temporary pleasure, indulgence, experience for something greater has lifelong consequences. So, renunciation, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, great Tibetan teacher of the last century, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche says of renunciation, renunciation implies the strong wish to free oneself not only from life's immediate sorrows, but from the seemingly unending cycle of conditioned existence. And with this renunciation comes a heartfelt weariness and disillusionment, with the endless quest for gratification, approval, profit, and status. Have you ever felt that? Endless treadmill, quest, rush, challenge to get, to have, to become, to consume more, more, more. Have you ever felt like, it'd be nice to not have to do that? To just step off that treadmill, to just kind of like take a break, rest, let it go. We all feel that at times. We all feel like, why am I on this incessant search for what? More of anything. And when we feel that, not out of aversion, not out of I don't like it, just out of enough already. That's the spark of renunciation in your own heart. And we all have that. We all have the understanding that ignites that spark. We all have this experience and this understanding that this endless pursuit for more is not ultimately satisfying. Yeah, there's the thrill of the pursuit, there's the enjoyment of the taste of getting and having, there's all that, and then what? We're looking for something else to pursue and to get and to have and to become. And you get it for a moment, and there's this brief moment of a kind of satisfaction, and then, oh, then there's something else to... Where does it end? Where does that endless pursuit for more stimulation, experience, where does it end? Who's going to end it for you? I mean, death will end it for this lifetime, right? But does that mean that's the only ending there is for it? Or are we condemned to just kind of run and chase and get and have and consume for these brief moments of satisfaction and then unsatisfaction or dissatisfaction to keep us going again? We've all settled into our comfort zone, right? With our careers and our relationship and our society and our political system. Not really. It could get better. That's the holdout, isn't it? It could always get better. And so we just keep, you know, just keep doing what we're doing, just kind of in our comfort zone, rather than saying, you know what, it's really uncomfortable or it's discomforting to kind of let go of that pursuit. Not because it's not worthy or not pleasant or not rewarding or not... We know why we do what we do. We get something for it. So, now when I talk about renunciation like this, don't think that it's just, as I mentioned, this severe deprivation and doing without things that you really need and want and enjoy. Because remember when you were a little tyke, a little kid, and you had your favorite toy, your favorite bike, your favorite friend, your favorite sport, your favorite musical instrument, whatever it was, that you just was the center of your life. You know, and every day you would just play with it, you'd do it, you'd kind of go to, you know, mine was swimming. I was lessons every morning, swimming all afternoon. It was just, that was great. It was great. And then I had a bike. I loved that bike. I was really a bike nut. Okay. Anyway, you know, you might have had your doll, you might have had your bike, whatever you had. Where is it now? Where is that thing? It might be in the attic, it might be in the cellar, but it's no longer in your heart. Right? So it no longer satisfies you. It no longer brings you the reward that it did before. Right? It's no longer exciting. It's no longer rewarding. It's no longer even pleasant. It's like, You've let go of it. You renounced it. It was painless. You didn't even notice it. Renunciation doesn't have to be this painful struggle to let go of what you really want. We outgrow a lot of things that we're attached to. And we haven't stopped growing. or at least we don't have to have stopped growing just because we've reached adult years. We, even in our earlier adult years, some of us have more early adult years, some of you have less early adult years, but nevertheless, in your earlier adult years, the things that you were involved in, the things that were rewarding, the things that were satisfying, the things that consumed your discretionary disk space and time, have you outgrown them? Or are you still holding on to them? And how will you know? I suggest, recommend, encourage you to do, I don't want to sound too 12-steppy here, but do an inventory. Go rummaging around in your attic of your mind, the attic of your heart, right? What is it that you're holding on to? What behaviors, beliefs, misbehaviors, assumptions, political views, stuff, sports, indulgences of one sort or another? What is it that you're holding on to that no longer serve your highest aspiration? And where do you want to go in life anyway? You know, you're all here tonight for some reason. What? Maybe it has something to do with an aspiration. If so, what is it that you're doing in your life that keeps you from doing this? Okay, so maybe there's something that we're carrying around, something we're indulging in, something that we're believing in, assumptions about life, activities of life that no longer serve our purpose or a value to us, and yet we still do them out of habit, out of not being aware that they are not leading anywhere. They're just consuming our time, our energy, and they're really not serving us in any way. How do we let go? Can we let go? So I want to talk about growing up, or I should say growing, period. Now, when I was younger, I've never been older than I am today. When I was younger, I used to be into the Grateful Dead. I still am, even just the recordings, but I used to enjoy their music and go to their shows as often as possible. Then I got involved in the Dharma and I started doing retreats. And after a few years of doing retreats, I had this magical, just, you know, really special conjunction of conditions. I was doing a 2-week retreat, you know, 14 days, silent, meditation, calm down, clear out, open up, get really sensitive. The last day of which the Grateful Dead were playing just an hour away, and I got tickets to the show. What could be better? 14 days of calm, clear, open, sensitive, go to the show. It was unbearable. It was so overwhelmingly loud and intense and just, you know what it's like. Maybe you don't, but anyway, it's intense. It was just such a disappointment. And it was just, I didn't know that though. I didn't know that because I've been a deadhead for a long time, still was, as far as I knew. It's just that I had actually found something of more value, meaning, purpose, aspirational, which is being calm, being aware, being open, being sensitive. Well, I didn't go to too many more shows. A few, but not too many. And became clearer what direction my life was going, and it wasn't going in that direction. So, what is it that you haven't realized that you've outgrown about your life? How are you going to identify it? How are you going to know? Okay. So, one of the, you know, the Buddha said to establish your life in the Dharma is of value to you. You're here tonight. It has some value to you. But to establish your life in the Dharma, there are three trainings that you need to undertake. They're called the three foundations of the Dharma, the three pillars of the Dharma, the three bases of development in the Dharma. And so to establish your life in the Dharma, if this is of value to you, and you want your life to be invested in the Dharma or awakening, I should say, let's say that. How about suffering less? How about, yeah. If you'd like to invest your life in suffering less, then there are three things that are required. The first is that you practice generosity. The second is that you practice ethical living, living in harmony within yourself and with others. And the third is to develop your mind. Develop your mind like we were practicing in the sitting meditation, developing your mind by learning how to calm down, but also learning how to understand wisely what your experience is. These are all practices of letting go, you might have noticed. Dana, generosity, is learning to what? Learning how to be generous, how to share what we have, which involves not just letting go of time, knowledge, material, stuff, finances, but it starts there, and it's learning how to let go of holding on. The primary lesson of generosity is not that you learn how to give things so much as you learn the activity of letting go. Oh, what it's like to do that with your mind. Just go, you know what? I've been holding on to this view, this opinion, this belief, this assumption, this thing, this person, the way I want it to be. That's all it takes. That's all it takes. Learning how to let go. And we practice letting go with people, with things. You see a need, you make an offering. It can be financial to a person on the street. It can be to an organization. You can let go of your knowledge by sharing what you know with others. You can serve, as many volunteers do here, with your time. Just being willing to share your time with others in this way. We learn to let go. The lesson is learning to let go. It's not what you let go of so much, it's learning to let go. So the Buddha said, if beings knew as I know the resultant benefit of generosity, they would not let any opportunity go by without sharing. They wouldn't let any opportunity go by without sharing. What did the Buddha know about generosity that he would say that? It's like, don't let an opportunity go by. So I was interested to hear Lindell talking about the practice of dana here at this talk. Of course, it's freely offered for those of you who come. And if you wish to support the Seattle Insight Meditation, you can make a donation there. If you wish to support my teachings, you can make a donation there. And that's good. That's how things can happen. That's how this whole show runs. More important than all that is you cultivate your own heart. You cultivate your own ability to let go. A little bit. Because holding on and getting more and having and getting and becoming and holding is only this much happiness. And learning how to let go is the source of all happiness. But it's hard, isn't it? It's really hard. Because we've been conditioned to think getting, having, becoming, holding, keeping, hoarding, even, is the way to happiness. It is generosity that one can rely on for one's own wealth, happiness, and humanity. One of the elders of our meditative tradition here, Mahasi Sayadaw, says, it is generosity that you can rely on for a sense of abundance in your life, for a sense of happiness. When you give to others, when you serve others, when you're able to support others in their need, you become happy. You want to be happy? Help others. That's it. And then humanity. I've told this story before. Some of you have heard it, no doubt. A few years ago, I was working with a group in another city. And I would go to the city half a dozen times a year, stay in a hotel in town, spend the time a day or a weekend with them. and share the Dharma. Staying in the hotel in the city, I'd never really lived in a city. I've always lived in rural farmland, really. But man, in this city, there were a lot of homeless people, a lot of panhandlers, a lot of beggars on the street, every street, every block, it seemed like a lot. Any was a lot to me. So I come out of the hotel and there they were. It's like, how am I going to get to the restaurant without passing these homeless people? And so I try to avoid them and kind of just walk by not seeing them and get to the restaurant. And after a couple of visits, I realized I'm really uncomfortable being around homeless people, panhandlers. I'm afraid of them. I don't like being around them because I don't understand. I don't know who they are. I don't know what they want. I'm afraid of being scammed. I'm afraid of being taken advantage of. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I just was really, I got anxious and fearful. So I tried to avoid them. But then I realized, I'm suffering. This is the great value of awareness practice, is it exposes your suffering. And if you're not seeing your suffering when you're practicing awareness, you're not practicing right. Right? When you remember to recognize the present moment, you're going to see fear at times. You're going to see anxiety. You're going to see self-judgment. You're going to see judgment of others. You're going to see impatience. You're going to see anger. You're going to see irritation. You're going to see all kinds of things. That's suffering. Oh, it's good to see suffering because then you can do something about it. If you're still in denial about your suffering, you're not going to do anything about it. You're going to keep suffering. And understand that impatience is suffering. Fear is suffering. Anxiety is suffering. Depression is suffering. Judgment, self-judgment and judging of others is suffering. It's dukkha. But we're so used to it, aren't we? We're so accustomed to it. It's become part of our personality. I'm not only impatient now, I'm always impatient. Not only always impatient, I'm an impatient person. Once you get that belief in your mind, I'm a depressed person, I'm a jealous person, I'm an angry person, I'm a rageful guy, I'm a whatever. That belief about yourself is almost impossible to leave, to uproot. A moment of impatience, you can see, oh, wow, I'm impatient right now. Let that go. Let me step back from that. Okay, you can do that in a moment. But once you've got a belief that I'm an impatient person, that is really deep, deeply rooted in our mind, our heart. Really difficult to get out. Where was I? I don't remember. Huh?
Homeless people.
Yeah, so I said, you know what, I'm suffering. I got to do something about this. So I made a vow, or I made it a practice to greet and meet and greet. I would go up to the homeless person, the panhandler, and say, how are you doing? What's going on today? How are you today? What do you need? What do you need? That got some interesting answers. But basically, I would just spend some time with them, meeting them. What's your name? How long you been here? And, well, they all had their story. It was all some form of suffering. I wasn't afraid of their suffering. And I was able to connect with them. And I was able to offer them something. You know, and then before I left, I would always offer them a token of financial gift, a dollar or two, occasionally five. But what I really gave them, in every case, was love. I recognize their humanity. I spend some time with them. I acknowledge them. I saw them like, hello, I see you. The dollar or the $5 didn't do anything. I mean, really. But the connection with another human being that cares, that does everything. And that's what we give every time that we're generous. We give out of our abundance for our happiness and a connection with humanity. Every time. From letting go. From not holding on. But sometimes, you know, we have these habits and difficult to let go. Anybody got any bad habits here? I don't mean just the ones you're acting out. I mean the ones you're thinking or feeling, the ones you get identified with. We all do. We all have some things that we obsess about, that we are compulsive about, or that we are, just torturing ourselves and others with. And so we hear this, you know, learning to let go is good. It's helpful. It's beneficial. But sometimes our behavior is so deeply habituated, it's very difficult to just say, oh, I'm going to stop doing that. When I was younger, I used to smoke tobacco and other things. But the tobacco was a habit that I didn't like. And when the Surgeon General came out with the report that if you continue to smoke, your lungs are going to look like this. And I saw those pictures and I said, I don't want that. You know, the possible consequences of smoking were terrifying. So even though I enjoyed smoking, and it was, you know, after a meal or with your coffee, whatever, nice to have a cigarette. There were other times when it's nice to have a cigarette. I said, yeah, that pleasure is good, but the possible consequences are not good. So, out of that knowledge of the possible consequences, I gave up smoking. And it really wasn't that hard, actually. I just said, I don't want to do that. Made a bet with a couple of friends, and that was it. Done. Wisdom, Norman Cousin says, is the anticipation of consequences. That is really wise, because when we anticipate consequences, we're using our knowledge, we're using our experience, we're extracting from our experience what we know. You know, if I continue to do this, it's, you know, possibly going to lead to some suffering. And if we can hear that, it's encouragement for us to let go of habits and behaviors that are, you know, not very skillful. Because as the Buddha said, even though the pleasure is great, the regret is greater. It's easy to do that which is of no real benefit to oneself, but it's difficult to do that which is truly beneficial and good. Speaking of which, we speak a lot, actually. We talk a lot. We listen a lot. We consume an immense amount of words through our own personal speaking, but through reading, listening. You know, the political discourse in this country is phenomenal. You can't avoid it, can you? Is anybody successful in avoiding it? No. Okay. So what is this doing to you? What is the consumption, just to take this example, What is your consumption of political discourse in this country doing to you? How many more articles do you need to read about shenanigans to be firmly convinced that it's not good? Do you have to read anymore? No. Right? Why do you read? Why do you do it? Because you read, you listen, you whatever it is, and you feel like irritated, maybe angry, maybe incredulous, maybe like reaffirming your judgments that you have already. Right? You feel good about it? Do you feel good after kind of consuming an hour worth of news? Do you feel better after an hour's worth of news than you did before you started? Who can do anything about that? Hello? Only we can, right? You can choose. It's like wisdom is the anticipation of consequences. You can be wise in your consumption of the news, or you can be foolish in your consumption of the news. I'm not saying to be a hermit and just kind of hide away and don't do anything. Don't stay involved in the social discourse, social political discourse of our lives, our communal lives. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, how much is enough? And how do you use speech in your life? Because it's such a ubiquitous part of our lives. You know, the Buddha has some guidance for speaking and listening. Really helpful. First of all, is not to sit in judgment of others, but to really look to yourself. Is what you speak true? Now, I'm not saying is what others say true. We know that. But is what you say true? Okay, why? Well, because when we can't tell the truth or don't tell the truth, we live in fear of somebody finding out. We got to tell other half-truths to support the big truth, big untruth that we told. We live in the world of deception. We're deceiving others. We're trying to deceive ourselves. We're pretending. We're creating delusion for others, right? We know the consequences of that. Right? Okay, so let me ask you something. Have you made a commitment, internal commitment, to always speak the truth? We live in a society that condones deception, supports, rewards even deception and mistruth, speaking, not speaking the truth. How can we live in a society that condones deception and not be conditioned and influenced by it? You have to be really, really aware, continuously aware, to watch your own mind around deception, because it's conditioned. We can't live in a, we can't boil in the, we can't marinate in this soup of deception in our society and not be conditioned by it. Cannot. And so we are, let's use that awful word, complicit, are we, in condoning deception. You know, that might be socially, politically necessary to kind of get by in life comfortably. But remember, I said, awakening is not about staying in your comfort zone. It's about stepping into your discomfort zone and learning how to live there, because it's necessary. If we haven't made a commitment to always speak the truth, you know what the other option is. How would you characterize that? Well, I'm a liar. Well, we are, aren't we? We all have limits to how truthful we can be. And it's important that we acknowledge that. Just so we're not fooling ourselves. No, don't think we're fooling ourselves. We might be able to fool somebody else, but you can't fool yourself. So then you have to live with that anxiety. You have to live with that fear of it being found out. You have to live with that, you know, misrepresentation. That's suffering. That's suffering right there. Okay. So the other qualities of speaking that the Buddha suggested we consider as a practice is speaking gently, even if others don't. Not only speaking the truth, but speaking it gently, coming from a place of caring for the other person, even if what you have to say to them is hard to hear or hard to say. Can we still have a care and compassion in our heart for them? And then the really two last challenging conditions for wise speech is what you have to say beneficial, or is it just gobbledygook, gossiping, you know, commenting, ranting, raging, whinging, whining, complaining, or is it really beneficial to someone? So the Buddha, of course, he was speaking to the monks and nuns who've made a commitment to devote their whole life towards awakening. But the Buddha had some suggestions for what is beneficial speech. Or I should say, he had some suggestions for what is not beneficial speech. First among them was talk about, well, the politicians of his day, kings and ministers. So, is that beneficial to your life of awakening and end of suffering? Something to consider. But anyway, you know, politicians, criminals, the opposite gender, or I should say, anybody, they talk about clothes, beds, jewelries, food, homes. The list is, well, everything that we talk about. All of TV, all of the news, and everything else of interest. But the Buddha didn't stop there. He had suggestions of what was useful and beneficial to talk about. Okay, so I'm going to list a few of those for you to consider as a topic for the next social evening when you go out with friends to the restaurant. Talk about renunciation, talk about simplicity, talk about striving strenuously to awaken, talk about your own morality, talk about, yeah. So next time you're going out with friends, you could suggest, let's talk about renunciation tonight instead of politics. Not easy to awaken. So, sometimes we can use knowledge to support our letting go, making choices that support our aspirations. Yeah. Oh, one more story. There's lots of stories, and I'm only on page 6 out of 10. Anyway, so one time I was in retreat when I was practicing as a monk, and you know, at this monastery it was 20 hours a day, alternate hours of sitting and walking, in silence, talk to your teacher 10 minutes a day, tell him what's going on, get some guidance to do another 24 hours. And after I'd been doing it for a few weeks or a couple of months or a few months, one of the monks that was in the monastery asked me, he said, this was kind of revealing, he says, do you ever practice without talking? And I go, I'm talking? He said, yeah, you talk a lot. I go, really? So I made this aspirational vow, well, I'm not going to talk for 3 days there. So I made this vow that I'm really going to pay attention to how much I was talking or speaking. And the first day, something happened. I had to talk to somebody about something. Second day, come around, I'm doing well. Oh, had to talk to somebody about something else. And on the third day, I also had to talk to somebody else. And I realized, I'm not very careful with my aspirations. But I kind of forgot about it for some period of time. Until later, some weeks later, one of the other monks that was there practicing with me saw that when some friends of mine came to the monastery from the States, I greeted them and was talking to them. It's actually Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg came to practice at the monastery, and I was excited to see them, so I was talking to them and, you know, just kind of catching up on life back in the homeland. And this other monk who'd been in the monastery with me for the last 6 weeks it had been, said, came up to me and said, oh, I see you're talking again. And I said, yeah, I was just meeting my friends, you know, Joseph and Sharon. And he said, you haven't spoken in 6 weeks. And I go, really? I didn't even know it. Which revealed to me the power of aspiration and commitment, even if you fail. It takes root in a part of the mind that is of value to you. So consider what it is, where it is that you're going, what are you aspiring to, and what is it that your life needs for continuing to grow? What is it you need to let go of? And even though you can't just command yourself to just let go, you can at least aspire. You can make a commitment. You can try. And sometimes just the sincerity of your aspiration, the sincerity of your commitment, has a power greater than your effort. So it's worth trying. So there's many other ways to let go. And I wish I had time to share them, like through training the mind, as we're doing in meditation, learning how to calm down the mind, learning how to put aside our habitual emotional reactivity of, you know, anxiety, whinging, whining, anger, fear, jealousy, desire. Also, learning how to let go through deeper understanding. The deeper understanding that everything is impermanent. Everything. What is it that you can hold on to when you know that it's impermanent? You can't hold on for very long. That's an insight into that. That understanding is an insight into the impermanence of all conditioned things. There's also the understanding of dukkha, of this pain. All things have this characteristic. All experiences have this characteristic of dukkha. They're either painful, or they're unstable and therefore not reliable as a source of security, or they're just oppressive. And when you understand that about life's experiences, it's painful, it's insecure, you're vulnerable, why would you hold on to that? Or the anatta characteristic, sometimes called selflessness, that's not a very good translation, but the conditioned nature of experience. All of our experience is like a conjunction of conditions come together, creates a moment of experience, and then the conditions fall apart and that experience disappears. But we try to hold on. It's like trying to hold on to a rainbow, reaching for and holding on to a rainbow. What's a rainbow? A rainbow is a colorful appearance due to causes and conditions. There is nothing. There is no rainbow, I'm sorry to say. There is no such thing as a rainbow. Thing. You can't grab it, you can't touch it, you can't wrap it up, you can't ship it to anybody, you can't. It's an appearance due to causes and conditions. It's colorful, it's enjoyable, great. Everything in life is just like that. A colorful appearance due to causes and conditions that you can't hold on to. When you understand this, when you understand that things are impermanent, when you understand that things have this dukkha characteristic, when you understand that things have this conditioned nature, why would you hold on? Why would you hold on to what is impermanent, what is painful, what is unstable, what is just a mirage, just an appearance? When the mind doesn't hold on, remember, Second Noble Truth, dukkha comes to an end, suffering comes to an end. So when we learn to let go, and we understand what we're letting go of, and the process of letting go, suffering comes to an end. Or I should say, let's just say, suffering is reduced. End? I don't know yet. Haven't got to the end yet. I'm on the way, just as you are too. But consider that it's from letting go. Not giving up the things that you need in life, but just the excess baggage, the misunderstandings, the wrong assumptions, the wrong beliefs, the self-judgment. Only you can do it. Nobody can do it for you. Nobody. Only you can do it. That's why we practice. We practice to expose the First Noble Truth, right? To really see, oh, this is suffering. This is my suffering. And then to see what it is that we have to let go of to stop suffering. That's why we practice. That's what this is all about. Right? I mean, there's a lot of benefits along the way, of course. A lot of other things happen. We have a community of friends. That's good. Yeah. We get a little calmer. That's good. We feel a little more authentic. That's better. We understand things more clearly. That's really good. There's all kinds of good reasons to practice. A lot of side benefits, collateral benefits, if you will. But mostly we just suffer less. When we let go, we release our grip. We release our heart from gripping anything. And as the Buddha said, The purpose of my teaching of this holy life of the Dharma, it's not for gaining merit. It's not for being a good person. And it's not for doing good deeds. It's not for rapture or joy or ecstasy. It's not even for concentration or samadhi. But it's for the sure heart's release. This and this alone is the reason for the teachings of the Buddha. The sure heart's release. Like that. So, simplify, let go. That's the message tonight. Thank you for listening. There's a few minutes if you have any comments or questions or stories you want to tell. Or if you don't have questions for me, I may have some for you. Like, what are you holding on to that's causing suffering? That's kind of a revealing question, isn't it? Or letting go of grief?
Yeah, so my best friend recently passed away. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
So I'm struggling with wanting to feel the emotions and not repress the emotions.
Wanting to feel the grief?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the same time, and pay homage to her.
Pay homage to her? You're having a lot of suffering.
And yeah, so I'm like, okay, I know that if I let go, it would be easier, but that feels like an awful thing to do. So I'm sort of struggling with that.
What the process of letting go of the grieving process is. Yeah, you know, it's not easy to let go. Some we can do intentionally, a lot of it we cannot. But we can be aware of it. So when, you know, just incidentally, Vipassana practice has been characterized as learning how to grieve effectively, because it is this recognition that every moment's experience comes, we taste it, and it goes. And to the extent that we can recognize that it has gone and experience the loss and feel the loss and accept the feeling of loss, then we learn how to grieve effectively. Now, in that sense, learning how to feel and how to and accepting the feeling of loss and the emptiness that happens, the emptiness in here that happens when you have a loss, is learning how to grieve effectively. Okay? So when someone passes away, and we've all had parents or friends or others, or if not, we will soon, that pass away. Of course, we have the memories of them, we have experiences with them, we have a relationship with them, and that all comes to an end. You know, and they're gone. And so that leaves a kind of hole in our heart, and the activities and all of the anticipation that we might have had with them, it's gone. So there's this emptiness here. You know, there's this emptiness outside of us, that the person is no longer there. What is also happening, and is maybe the hardest part to acknowledge, is that my sense of myself is different. I've been changed. Who I was in that person's eyes, how I was with that person, is now gone. My sense of self has come to an end. That sense of myself has ended. And that leaves a real hole. That leaves a real feeling of emptiness, of there's nothing here-ness. That's really hard to be with, to accept, and to allow to be there. we're usually in a big hurry to fill it back up with, you know, holding on to something or finding another person or something to fill up that feeling in there. And sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it is very difficult to feel that loss of the other person reflected in the loss of a sense of self. Really hard or difficult. So it takes time. I've seen my grieving process seems to have its own trajectory where I might want to be done grieving, but the grieving is not done with me. And so, in that sense, patience and being willing to really feel what this feeling of loss and grieving and sadness about it and the emptiness that I feel, you know, you feel empty. You just feel stunned-like. You know, it's not, words don't fill it up. You know, and being willing to hold our attention there, to being willing to inhabit that, let our heart marinate in that feeling. Yeah, difficult. And it'll happen. It will happen. If you're at all interested, you'll be aware of it. Otherwise, it'll just happen and you won't be aware of it. But yeah. Thank you for your question. I'm sorry to hear. And it can't be unexpected. You know, hello. We're human. All things that live die. Okay. Just not when we want, you know, or when we anticipate. Other comments, questions? I was having a discussion with my landlord here today. A good friend of his passed away suddenly, just a week or 10 days ago. But his own wife passed away a few years ago after a long, 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 long illness. And he was just comparing and contrasting the two ways of leaving this world, knowing that it's inevitable and this is the trajectory, this is the doctor's prognosis and timeline, and just having, you know, years to just be with the inevitable process and what can be learned from that and how minutely the losses occur just day to day, just loss of everything and being aware of everything that you lose moment to moment, you know, until you lose the breath. Huh? And then there's the other way of, I'm going out for my jog, be back in a bit. Then come back. Ooh. There's that way of going too. So, how do we know when to let go? What is it we have to let go of? The Buddha suggested that we reflect on our own death every day. Every day. Just call to mind. I am heir to dying. I'm not yet free of dying. You know, and the timing of death is unknown for any of us. And yet it is inevitable for all of us. Since all others must die, I too must die. And, you know, it's not to get morbid about yourself or not to get anxious about it or not to kind of like try to finish up your bucket list or anything. It's not that. It's just to kind of bring this known fact of life. I call it the adult facts of life. Bring the adult facts of life right into your heart so you live with it. You do what you got to do, of course, and live with the fact of life. I hope we can all make it home safely tonight. You never know. You really don't know. We assume that, oh yeah, but we don't know. How, what? If we could be that aware, we would really have a lot more care for one another. At least I would. Yeah?
A little bit more of a comment. I recently also just lost a really dear friend. But just while you're thinking about the things you've let go of since my practice started, I don't know, a while ago, it just occurred to me, I don't know if, like, I've let go of something without picking something else up. So it might have been going out and having beers with my friends, picking up playing the guitar. But just that whole process of letting things go often get filled maybe with something more skillful. But I was sitting there thinking, like, I can't really think of two things I've let go without something else swapping in its place.
Yeah.
I really can't. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good observation that, you know, a lot of what we let go of is filled by what we pick up next, right? And some of it's things, some of it's beliefs, behaviors, stuff like that. But even in the process of learning how to let go, we can learn to let go quicker